underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Caleb Carr is the best-selling author of The Alienist and The Angel of Darkness, among many others. He has created a contemporary psychological thriller haunted by the shadowy hands of established power in his new novel, Surrender, New York. In rural impoverished Burgoyne County, New York, a pattern of strange deaths begins to emerge. Adolescent boys and girls are found murdered. Meanwhile, in the county's small town of Surrender, Trajan Jones, a psychological profile, and Michael Lee, a trace evidence expert, once famed advisors to the New York City Police Department, teach online courses in profiling and forensic science from Jones's family farm. Alone and armed mainly with their wits, the outcast pair are secretly called in to consult on the case. Again, the novel is Surrender, New York. It is published by Random House. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Caleb Carr back to The Book Show. Thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure.
Thank you, Joe. It's great to see you again.
Very nice to have you back on the program. In some ways, this is at least connected to The Alienist, but I assume you don't think of it as a sequel.
No, it's not at all a sequel, but it is an embodiment of the same techniques that were used in The Alienist, because Trajan Jones is the world's leading expert on Laszlo Kreitzer, who was The Alienist. And he basically teaches that a lot of the same methods and theories that Kreitzer came up with are still effective today, despite the fact that everybody thinks they're not, because of these supposedly remarkable scientific advances that have been made in forensic science, a lot of which are not really what anybody thinks, because of television and movies. They're not, you know, real forensic science is not what you see on television and movies. And so he has to sort of disabuse his students of that fact, and he teaches them more basic stuff, a lot of which goes back to the fact that psychology itself, effective psychology still owes a great deal to what was going on in the late 19th and early 20th century.
And I assume what drew you to want to write a contemporary book is this notion that science has brought us so far, and we can in some way, with just a little bit more and a few more pushes, we can eradicate crime altogether.
It was that, and it's also the terrible things that are happening with arrests and in courtrooms, because forensic science has now been, when criminal science became forensic science, which basically happened in the, let's say it happened in the 1920s, really for real, with J. Edgar Hoover. The entire bent of it became prosecutorial. You know, when the state took it over, it was to catch and convict, find evidence that would convict people. There was no notion of independent criminal science that would go at it to say, well, what happened, and whatever we find out, we follow. And if it's the wrong thing, if we're on the wrong lead, we're on the wrong lead. But, there's this tremendous prosecutorial bent, which has led to, as we've seen, enormous numbers of people being wrongfully imprisoned and enormous numbers of people being wrongfully executed. And it's hard to think over the last century how many people have been wrongfully imprisoned and executed because of faulty, supposedly up-to-date science, which we now know, a lot of which just wasn't good enough.
Where do you think we went wrong in the sense of losing that idea of psychological profiling? That was
mainly with DNA. When DNA came along, people said, "Well, we don't really need to know the psychological stuff anymore. We just need to know somebody's DNA, you know, fingerprint, and that's going to tell us everything we need to know." And the problem is, DNA like everything else in forensic science, depends completely on who gathers it and analyzes it. There are a lot of good people who do it. There are an awful lot of people who are not good at it, which has led to a great many scandals in a great many labs across the country, leading right up to the FBI's famed behavioral science unit in Quantico, in which was the famous lab in Silence of the Lambs, which was kind of portrayed as being infallible, mm-hmm. which we discovered 20 years ago was far from infallible.
When you look at these two, Trajan Jones and Michael Lee, one a psychological profiler, as I mentioned, the other a trace evidence expert, talk a little bit about their background in working with the New York City Police Department and how ultimately they do work together and why that is such a good coupling.
Well, they were officially advisors to the New York City Police Department. The New York City Police Department has a great many advisors who are effectively auxiliaries to the department, but they still maintain their independence because their big thing is we don't practice forensic science, we practice criminal science, meaning that if you don't like our findings just because they don't prove out the, you know, the suspect that you want to get or the theory that you want to uphold, too bad, that's our findings. As the story goes, they crossed a few too many high-powered people a few too many times and got exiled, basically. But it's a good coupling because I do want to show that with Trajan Jones that psychological profiling still has an enormous role to play in criminal detection, but also if you can get people who are independent, because the big problem is when criminal science, as I say, became forensic science, that's when it all started to go wobbly and bad. And Mike Lee is a trace evidence expert, but he's an independent trace evidence expert in the sense that he doesn't have that prosecutorial bent. He doesn't want to prove out hunches and prove out things that people that are the easiest suspects, which, you know, a great, enormous percentage of the time is what the law wants, is the person who's the most apparent suspect, the person who they like, as they say, for the crime. You just can't do it that way. And that's why we have now, you know, the most enormous number of people in prison other than China.
When you look at this character of Trajan Jones, he's basically an exile in mm-hmm. northern New York, in upstate New York. And what is he hoping to accomplish there?
He's teaching. They're teaching together. They're doing online courses for the School of Criminal Justice at SUNY Albany, mm-hmm. Which is a very good school. And SUNY is trying to catch up with the scandals. They're trying to catch up with, you know, they've taught forensic science, obviously, for a long time. They're trying to catch up with all these scandals that have happened and offer some courses that are maybe corrective to what has been taught for a long time. So they get plugged into the, you know, when they become available, they get offered jobs doing this. So they do it. And they offer to do it as online courses. So they're getting kids not only from, you know, SUNY itself, but from all over the country.
Caleb Carr is our guest on this week's book show. The name of the new novel is Surrender, New York. It is published by Random House. So there is this spate of horrific crimes. It's believed to be the work of a serial killer. So what brings us to these two, where things go so wrong, where we say, all right, let's have these two take a crack at it?
It turns out that the first death they're brought in on is not actually the first death in the series. And the county law enforcement guys, the sheriff of the county, his deputy, the local state troop commander, they don't like the fact that they're being pushed toward this idea of a serial killer because they're just not sure of it. but the state itself seems to be moving very fast toward the conclusion of a serial killer, almost anxiously, which is weird. And they sense that it's weird. They look at it and they decide that the overwhelming probability is that it is not a serial killer. They never rule anything out. We go back to the old Sherlock Holmes theory that, you know, everyone's a suspect, nothing is ruled out. That's really important to remember, because Conan Doyle was really on to the idea of criminal science, that you don't rule anything out until you have the facts and the evidence to back it up. And they talk about that at the beginning, about the indebtedness to people like Conan Doyle and then Kreitzer. So they start investigating a different angle. And as they get more and more into this different angle they're investigating, they discover that their own lives are in danger. And then they start to realize that the state is very anxious for them to stop, because they want this theory, for some reason, they want this idea, for some reason, the idea of having a serial killer at work is more important to them than something else that might be happening, which poses the question of a certain kind. I don't want to give any spoilers away, so I have to put it carefully, but there's a certain kind of political scandal which it might be more desirable to lay off on a serial child killer than to actually reveal what's happening.
I was struck at some point while reading the novel that this is, in its genre of a crime novel, there is such a tendency for them to be fast-paced, to have a very quick feel to them, and every page leaves you up in the air. Your book very much takes its time. It's at a lovely pace. You have a lot of description. It's very in depth in its history and its study and the look at science and, of course, these characters. What I find fascinating about that is that it really goes to show the overall problem that we're having in the subject, which is we're so quick to want to solve the problem.
Right.
We're so quick to get to the end of the novel that we don't take time to just sort of stop and say
and explore every detail.
Right. And look at stuff.
And that's a reflection of their method on the one hand, of going into every possible detail in depth, which, you know, I always find fascinating, but that may be because of my upbringing and my training. You know, I really was less influenced as a writer by any contemporary mystery fiction than I was going back to 19th century writers. I mean, that's always where I get my main influence from, is 19th century and early 20th century writers. And they proceed at a more, some of them for, you know, practical reasons, mm-hmm. wanted to proceed at a more leisurely pace. Some of them just did it because of its style. I prefer that. I prefer, you know, that if somebody just says something, well, I immediately have 10 different questions about what they say that don't get answered. And I would prefer to go into all of those 10 different questions rather than jump to the next conclusion. But you're right. It's a sort of a weird thing that's happened ever since, I would say, probably in the post-war world, mm-hmm. that mystery novels have tended to want to be, you know, the Sam Spade, cut and dried, you know, boom, 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 here we go. But even Chandler didn't, you know, his style was that way, but he did not ignore details ever, and he didn't leap to conclusions. And Dashiell Hammett and people like that, they never left any stone unturned. And even now, the guys who are really good do that as well. Even if stylistically it's very different, they still tend to look in more detail. But you're right. It is a more some people are saying it's a 19th century writing style. Mm-hmm. I'll own that. I mean, I'll confess to that. It is more of a 19th century writing style. It is a book you have to take time with. But as one of my Pierce just said in print, you know, that's the way my books have always been.
Right.
You know, the books about the 19th century were that way too.
Michael Connelly writing in the New York Times about the fact that this is a book that takes its time and a contemporary crime thriller with many messages and meanings.
Right, which I take as a huge compliment because I love Connelly's writing, but I had no idea whether he would like mine. I had no idea whether he liked mine. I mean, I've never met Michael. I may have met him like 20 years ago, just in passing, but I don't think so. And I was pretty stunned that he liked it as much as he did, just stylistically. Mm-hmm. Just forget about the story, just stylistically, because it is. But it proves to you that writers, good writers, always want to take time for different kinds of stuff. I mean, like I say, his books are very different than mine, but I love them. And some of them, you know, have doubtless influenced me.
Connelly's pedigree is that of a journalist, of a beat reporter in Los Angeles covering crime. Your background is that of a military historian. And he certainly uses his background in his novel writing. You certainly use your background in writing your novels, including this one.
True. I was generally obsessed with history at first, and then it became, in college, it became military and diplomatic history. And it was, again, mainly focused on the 19th century. And you can't help but bring that to the table when you do your own stuff. And you can see that. But I don't think that, I wouldn't call Connelly's writing necessarily his novels necessarily journalistic. There are novels that I would call journalistic,
yes.
But his books are actually, you know, much more thoughtful than just journalism. I don't think that a 19th century style has to be necessarily unexciting or slow or difficult.
Is it, looking at the ideas that you explore in this novel, we talked about the science and the possibility that with that science we've gone too far and we've made major mistakes. Is the conclusion that we come to ultimately that it takes a little bit of both? It takes that psychological, that we can't dispense with the science because that can assist us as well, but we do have to go into that psychological profiling.
No,
well.
That's why there's the initial opening quote about, you know, the curse of knowledge, that we can't unknow what we know about forensic science.
Right.
But what we can do is redefine it. We have to be able to go back to the idea of criminal science. And that's the thing that I would really love to see is criminal science once again becoming an independent arm of law enforcement, not, you know, because that's the thing that really happened under J. Edgar Hoover. J. Edgar Hoover kind of took it over during the Lindbergh kidnapping. He kind of set up the first national lab in Washington, and it became this thing. And they went out and got, you know, got Bruno Hauptmann, who was probably the wrong guy. And that set the pattern to use it to get, you know, results quickly and to get results that were satisfying to the public. What I'd like to see is that it gets set up back as its own arm, you know, not part of the FBI, not part of local law enforcement, not part of state law enforcement, its own agency. Criminal science should be. But you do need the science. But you need the psychology too.
One of the other issues that you tackle in the novel is that of what you refer to as the throwaway teenager.
Mm-hmm.
How pervasive is that in our world, do you think? And why is it something that you wanted to explore?
It's something I stumbled on by accident. I was going through a lot of New York State childcare records, and there kept being repeated this term, throwaway children. Now, I had seen the term thrownaways meaning is just a sort of a nicer way of saying kids who have been kicked out of their house by their parents. But throwaway children is actually this new phenomenon, relatively new phenomenon that's hit with this economy of, with this, you know, grotesquely unequal economy where parents, kids just wake up one day and their families have disappeared and they're on their own. They have no idea where they've gone. They can't find them. Nobody else can find them. And these kids are trapped because the whole system is set up so that, you know, all the safeguards, suddenly all the safeguards that are put there that are meant to protect these kids work against them. You know, they can't get a job. They can't go back to school because they have no, you know, the only alternative is to do what no kid wants to do, which is go anymore, which is to go into foster care, which is now, you know, widely and correctly seen as mostly a for-profit system on the part of foster parents. So it was remarkable for me to find it. And then I started snooping around and finding it in other states. People don't want to talk about it. That's where we get into the political scandal in the book, that perhaps is more important to be hushed up than even the idea of a serial killer of children, which is really nothing remarkable anymore. In fact, it's, you know, with all the obsession with serial killer novels and TV shows, people kind of enjoy serial killer stories now. So there's a certain lurid fascination that you can exploit with the public, as opposed to a political scandal over what's happening to children in this economy. Nobody wants to deal with that.
What do you think that is? Because we care about kids. Why don't we care about these kids?
We can't overhaul the system, apparently. This is a real problem because our current governor came in pledging to do a great deal more for precisely these kind of children, children who had been lost somehow in society. Whether he has not been able to or whether he has been preoccupied with other things, I would leave that to people's individual judgment. I would say he's got his own problems on his hands. but the simple fact of the matter is, to deal with this sudden kind of problem, you would have to really take a hard look at what's wrong with the foster care program. Why isn't there a way to get kids back in school if their families disappear on them? Why isn't there a way to allow kids to work at an earlier age if that happens, or at least work part-time? And everybody throws their hands up and says, no, that's child labor. It is child labor. But the thing is, the alternatives they're presented with too often are some kind of illegal activity. There's foster care, like I say, on the one hand, or some kind of illegal activity. I mean, you got to make a living somehow. If you're 13, 14 years old and you're suddenly alone on the streets and the system's not going to take care of you and you don't want to go into foster care, all too often you're going to go into prostitution, drug dealing, breaking and entering, in much the way that Dickens wrote about kids being used in breaking and entering in the 19th century. You know, kids are still very useful to get into small places that adult thieves can't get into, windows that they can't crawl through and stuff. And this happens. Nobody wants to do it. You know, nobody wants to go over the whole system and say, okay, where did it break down and what can we do?
I don't think I'm giving anything away in telling listeners that it seems that you leave the door open for a sequel to this.
Oh, I did leave the door open. Whether or not it's going to, you know, it seems to have swung open a little more, thanks to my friend Michael Connelly. But, you know, we'll see. I am now contracted to do two more Alienist books.
Mm-hmm.
I've got to get those done. And, you know, Surrender stands on its own. It would be fine if a sequel never happened, but if one was really called for, very easy to do. I mean, these guys are basically in the same situation they were when they started. You know, they've succeeded, but nobody's going to admit that they've succeeded because of the depth of the Now that's a spoiler. I can't say that.
Okay. Caleb Carr's new novel is Surrender, New York, published by Random House. Caleb Carr, thank you very much for being and sharing with us.
Great to be here again. Thank you.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org or via podcast. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.